You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news from Henbury, it's Bristol's first UKIP councillor, Michael Frost. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Royal Mail, the world's first great postal service, is like a dying wildebeest being bitten and poisoned by Komodo dragons. Sapping the lifeblood of our postal service now are scores of private mail firms who just cherry-pick the easy jobs, leaving Royal Mail to do all the expensive, difficult bits. How long before Royal Mail collapses and dies? Also, frackers poisoning the water, causing earthquakes and ruining the countryside. Also, the coalition has changed the law now so that they own the land under your house, not you. So you have no say in whether the frackers drill right underneath your home. So are the frackers the new energy saviours, or just more greedy crooks helped by the government to make money while trashing the environment? Parliament was being recalled today, although you wouldn't necessarily know it if you were to listen to BBC 5 Live, who are covering the Ryder Cup golf wall to wall. So they've been discussing whether or not to attack Iraq from the air. Gulf War 2, is it? Or Iraq War 2? This time anyway, it looks like no boots on the ground, just British bombs going to fall on the bad guys, and probably civilians too. But we ask what they don't. Is ISIS a creation of the West? Are some of our so-called allies actively aiding the terrorists? And could we stop ISIS overnight if we really wanted? Plus, Martin Summers will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13, getting cooler now, isn't it, and dry. This weekend, highs of 21, fairly cloudy, though, with some sunny spells over the weekend, a bit warmer. Next week, highs of 21, fairly cloudy again, with sunny spells, and next weekend, the 4th and 5th of October. Still sun, but cooler at 16. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news from Henbury, it's Bristol's first UKIP councillor, Michael Frost. Hi, Michael, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you. Good evening.
First of all, why did you stand in Henbury for the UK Independence Party?
Well, really, I was a disaffected Conservative voter, and having reviewed all the policies that the current Conservative government were putting forward, I realised I had nobody to vote for. I couldn't contemplate voting for the Labour Party, and the Lib Dems just constantly made me laugh. So
What was the problem with the other parties if you were disillusioned with the Tories?
The problem with the other parties? Well, I just don't think the Labour Party present a credible opposition in the current line-up that they have at the moment. If you listen to Ed Miliband's speech at conference, I think it can only be best described as lacklustre, whereas it should have been a cry for battle. He's certainly no orator. Some of the great Labour orators like Michael Foot and people like that, that really had some gravitas. You know, this guy comes across as a university, you know...
I'm trying
to be careful with my language, really, if the truth is known. But he just comes along as he's a boy trying to be a man. And, I plead with anybody voting Labour at the next election, you know, if you are dyed-in-the-wool Labour voters, then please just review what you're going to do, because you may end up with Ed Miliband as Prime Minister and Ed Balls as Chancellor of the Exchequer.
No, it's all very well to go... most of the press has done this as well, to go for Ed Miliband as a person, but not for the policies. I mean, that's actually dumbing down politics when you start talking about, well, it's all about personalities, not about policies.
No. I'm looking at the policies they've got. Some of the things they're saying just don't really stack up in this day and age. His speech didn't mention the deficit. He didn't mention immigration, and all these things are absolutely key not only to the country, but also to the man in the street now. If you go into any pub or club and you do get into any political situation, these are the two key things that people are concerned about.
OK, before we get on to discuss what your thoughts are on the Lib Dems, Martin, let's let you maybe answer some of that about the, should we say, personality deficit and policy deficit with Ed Miliband and the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, this is fairly common. These opinions are fairly common. I'm a very dyed-in-the-wool Labour supporter. I've been a member of the party since 1975, and to my mind, the leadership have always been rubbish. There's no change. People should vote Labour.
Oh, I'll agree with that.
But people should vote Labour because it's the only way to protect things like the NHS. I mean, they're pretty half-hearted in their views from my point of view. But on the other hand, in the real world, UKIP are not going to form the next government. They might hold the balance of power.
That's what we're going for. Well, we know full well.
And I personally would like to see the electoral system changed so that we had a more choice, because the Labour Party ends up being a ragbag of disparate elements because of the electoral system. That's what keeps us all in the same box. And of course, if it was a more open system, as we've got in Scotland, for example, then you've got a more open game to play.
That's the most refreshing thing I've ever heard from a Labour voter.
Yeah, well, I'm not just a Labour voter; I'm a Labour activist, but I'm not right. A member. I'm not a member of the hierarchy. Let's put it that way.
Okay, Michael, back to your thoughts on the Lib Dems. Why not the Lib Dems?
Well, who can trust? Let's look at it this way: politicians, of generally speaking, have got a pretty low watermark when it comes to trust. You know, we've had the expenses scandal, which really just blew Westminster apart, and everybody had their snout in the trough there. So I'm casting no aspersions at any one party. You know, we had stories about duck islands and some of that you just couldn't make up.
But the backstory to the whole expenses business was that they hadn't given MPs a pay rise that year, and what they'd said to them was, look, just because it's politically difficult to do it, what you do is you just claim a bit more expenses for the next couple of years.
Well, they just drove a coach and horses through it, and you're absolutely right. This goes back for decades, really, where we've never paid our MPs proportionately, let's put it like that. And I think there was an open agreement, an unsigned agreement, if you like, that the MPs could, you know, make up their salaries and whatever by using the expenses system. When really, if you give a dog a whole bag of dog food to eat, then he's going to try and eat it till he's sick. And I think that's what a lot of MPs did. Unfortunately, I believe that there should be one standard salary for an MP. I wouldn't like to say what it was, but it needs to be commensurate with the calibre of person we need to do a job like this. And then they should fund their own expenses and assistance and all the rest of it, so everybody knows where they stand.
If pay is related to calibre, I mean, the best people in the country, of course, are our bankers.
Well, that's your opinion.
Well, because they get paid so much, don't they?
Well, they get paid so much because they're in an industry so that's awash with cash and corruption, you know, so I think opening that can of worms, Tony, is quite a big one.
We'll talk about the economy a bit more and the possible reasons for it, but what about you personally? What's your, do you have a day job?
Yes, I do.
And your background coming into politics?
Well, my background, how far do you want to go back? I'm quite happy to go back as far as you like.
I suppose your working life, maybe.
Well, I grew up on a council estate in Stevenage in Hertfordshire. I had two loving parents who worked hard, still do. Well, they're retired now. I was a Labour voter. In my early political career, I was actually a senior shop steward for the Transport and General Workers Union.
And what was your workplace?
In transport. I was a lorry driver.
Right.
What really turned me over to the Conservative Party was the 1979 winter of discontent, where Sonny James Callaghan had the whole streets piled high with rubbish, dead not being buried. And those of you that are old enough to remember that, especially working and living in around London, it was like a medieval city. The whole place just stank to high heaven, and I thought, what sort of government can allow this to happen?
Also, so what brought you then into what you're doing nowadays? Work-wise.
Okay, well, I came out of transport when I was not really fit enough to do it anymore, and I went into sales, and I spent some years in financial services. I then spent a few more years in the fledgling mobile communications industry, business to business, and then from there, I've been a direct salesman for home improvement.
And so how do you manage to juggle that with being a councillor?
It's very difficult. Fortunately, I have an agency with the company that I work for, so I can run my own diary. So at the beginning of the month, I have to block out whatever meetings that I need to attend, obviously full council meetings, extraordinary general meetings, and anything really that I think will assist me to help the good people of Hengrove who elected me last May.
One of the things that people often say about UKIP is, well, basically UKIP is our closet racists, that people in UKIP actually don't like immigrants, and they are against them, that even the immigrants that have been here coming to Britain for the last 40, 50, 60 years.
Tony, I think that fox was shot many, many moons ago. Anybody that thinks that UKIP is a racist organisation clearly haven't looked at us or understood what we're about. We are not anti-immigration. What we're really saying is that our membership in the EU, which we hope to curtail and bring to an end, gives us an open border, and anybody from Europe can come here. We've got no idea who's coming and who's going. A lot of the immigration is work migrants. We've got enough of our own young, unskilled people in this country that need work to do without importing a whole load more that really we're going to have to support. And I dread to think what it could be like in 5 years' time, because the economies of Spain, Italy, Greece have all collapsed. Their unemployment rates amongst the young in Spain are running at over 50%. Now, those people are going to want to work, and they're going to go to where they think there is work. And unfortunately, most of Europe think that the UK is the promised land and the streets of London are paved with gold, and they're not.
So what are you going to do about immigration? Because at the moment, I just came in through an airport a couple of weeks ago, and there's a quick passport check. That's it. I mean, OK, I'm a UK citizen, but I could see the people next to me. They're trying to get people into the country as quick as possible, and actually no kind of customs, anything like that.
No, you're absolutely right. We're going to stop it.
I mean, because we're part of Europe, aren't we?
Part of Europe at the moment, yeah.
Surely the idea is that once you're in Europe, you can move around. Surely that's actually a really good idea, that people from Britain can go get a job in Germany if they want to, because so many people in Germany are English speaking. A lot of people in Europe are English speaking too, and that is surely going to be good for business ultimately, to have mobility of labour.
It depends what labour it is. You know, the sort of people that go and work in Germany, generally speaking, you know, are of a level of either education or skills that they can take to Germany and other countries. And I am generalising here, and I know you are too, but you know, it doesn't take a lot of working out that most of the immigration that comes from Europe to this country are economic migrants. You've only got to look at the news footage of a couple of weeks ago, where they had hundreds of Africans and Moroccans and Libyans actually trying to jump onto a ferry to get to England. Stories of them hanging on the back of lorries, trying to hide on the train and all the rest of it. And if you ask them why they're coming here, they all say roughly the same thing. They give you money, they give you a house.
Martin, what's your thoughts on Labour leader Ed Miliband missing out any reference to immigration in his keynote speech at the Labour Party conference this week?
I think he just forgot, because he didn't have any notes and he was speaking for 80 minutes.
Is that good enough? Because this is a big issue across the country, isn't it?
It is an issue, and it certainly needs to be discussed. I think he would probably say, I should have mentioned it, I forgot. This is what he's bound to say, isn't it?
Sorry, teacher. But, yeah. I mean, you know, what is Labour Party's policy then? Speak for him.
This is always going to be a difficult one, because even if we were outside the EU, these people would still be trying to get in, and they're not legal immigrants anyway, as things stand. You know,
no, you're absolutely right.
The real problem is we've got a banking collapse in 2008, which has basically put the whole world on a tightrope, and the economy is. I think there's going to be a further collapse, and the euro is possibly going to collapse. When the euro collapses, the banking system will go down. Well, Deutsche Bank, for example, in Germany, is massively exposed to Greece. So if there had been a Grexit, as suggested by Nigel Farage a couple of years ago, that would have pulled down the banking system. That's why they're pumping money into it, to keep it afloat, because if it goes down, we're then going to have mass unemployment across Europe, and the likely outcome of that is not just in Britain but everywhere else.
Well, Ed Miliband missed out out the economy, conflict. Martin, but he also missed out immigration. I want you to just spell out to us what the Labour Party's policy
the
is.
The policy is, and I'm sure that Michael wouldn't disagree with this, is there's got to be fairness and transparency in it. And that's what everybody says they want, but in practice it doesn't work out like that.
No.
I think Norway, for example, is outside the EU. They didn't want to join the EU because they've got the Labour Party ran Norway from 1940 until quite recently, and they just thought the EU was too capitalist oriented for their tastes. But of course, they kept control of their borders. But nevertheless, you've still got lots of people from outside Norway living in Norway. The real world has moved on. You know, things change. You know, the world is very different. I mean, you were brought up in Stevenage and London, but obviously got some time in London. I mean, big cities like that are very different from what they were 50 years ago. And that's all over the world. That's mm-hmm. true. I think it's a real problem everywhere is that we've got an economic system that just doesn't work for ordinary people. And that, therefore, there's huge tension. I used to live in Poland before they were in the EU. I used to work over there. And all these youngsters in Poland said, well, why can't we come to England? We speak English. We've been your friends for years. We're on your side in World War II. Lots of our people fought in your military. Why can't we come? I said, do you want everybody in Russia to come to Poland? They went, oh, no. I said, well, now you see what the problem is. And that's the problem everywhere in the world. There's always somebody further down the line.
Michael, isn't there actually a positive side to all this? In that when you've got people moving from country to country a lot, there's less chance of those countries falling out with each other. You've got lots of Poles in Britain, you know, Brits moving, taking jobs at other parts of the country. Surely, the bonus was the socialist post-war dream, wasn't it? The idea
of grouping everybody together and making us all Europeans would stop us trying to murder each other. You know, well, I mean, that's very, very outdated now. And I have heard that come up on numerous occasions. Listen, this needs to be quite a simple thing. We are a small island, we are grossly overpopulated, and we just can't allow all these people to come to Britain. We just can't do it because we are going to end up collapsing. What's happening to our social services? You know, at the moment we've got primary schools that have no idea how many pupils they're going to have in the very near future at all. We've got the NHS, which is creaking at the seams because people come over here and because they're Europeans, they can access our National Health Service. Now, I'm not trying to be unkind here at all, but there's only so much that we can do. We can't be a National Health Service to the whole of Europe. That all that's going to do is collapse our national health, you know, more than it already is.
Well, let's look at the economy. What Ed Miliband didn't do in his speech, and this week we've heard from Ben Chew announcing this as the economics editor of The Independent. George Osborne's public finances headache worsened this week as official figures showed the deficit in August came in at £11.6 billion. That's £700 million more than the same month last year and higher than any city expectations. The Office for National Statistics said public borrowing for the tax year to date is £45.4 billion, 6% more than the same stage in 2013-14, that's last year. Weak income tax receipts are primarily responsible for the overshoot. The annual comparison has been distorted by strong receipts early last year. But the income tax and national insurance receipts were still weak in August, rising by just 1.6% year on year, despite record employment numbers. So this is bizarre. Martin, maybe you can explain this. National insurance receipts and income tax receipts only marginally up, actually less than inflation. Why is that, since we've got so many people apparently unemployed?
It's not that difficult. Lots of people in work are still on benefits and reclaiming housing benefit, for example. It's because the labour market has changed since the days when Michael was working in the transport industry. Real wages do not rise under a modern setup because the unions have been broken down. And therefore, the only reason why the economy has picked up, because of course they were trying to reduce the deficit too fast. They stopped doing that as the election hove into view, and they took the foot off the deficit reduction because they want to win the election. And of course also when they did that, the economy started to pick up, but it's all based on printing money and a property bubble, which will burst as the property bubble in the 80s and the 90s burst. And when this property bubble bursts, it'll also be related to a collapse in the US because the Federal Reserve, the stock market was down this morning all over the world because the Federal Reserve is talking about raising interest rates even slightly. The capitalist system as a system is broken. broken. And when it collapses, there's going to be a world war. And there'll be lots more immigrants as a result of that, as there was in World War II.
Michael Frost, you're Bristol's first UKIP councillor for Henbury. What do you make of the figures we've heard this week? Osborne is supposed to be getting the deficit down, but we hear public borrowing has risen to £11.6 billion.
Well, you've got to look at what the root cause of that was. You know, if you're looking at the PFI initiatives, I mean, that was really brought on by Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, you know, when they actually hocked up the country to the hilt trying to support all of their Never Never Land Labour policies,
well,
buying schools and hospitals.
I do wonder about PFI. Every time I drive past Southmead Hospital, looks wonderful, but it's costing a fortune.
It's costing, and does it work? I mean, it'd be interesting to see if we had a phone in from Bristolians that have had to use the new hospital. It's been an unmitigated disaster. Absolutely. You know,
I was quite worried that the head of finance at North Bristol NHS Trust, I think it was Liam Nevin in the guy's name, before the project was completed, he left his job. So he's set up all the finance for the PFI, but before he's not in the position.
What do you think he knew then?
Well, I don't know. I just find that sort of thing extremely worrying, where people are prepared to sign the bits of paper to do one of these PFI deals, but they're not around to face the consequences.
Yeah. Well, we're facing the same problems now, aren't we? It's all right, you know, looking at the chance of the day and saying, ah, well, look at all this mess we're in, you know, and there's Ed Ball standing up going, ah, oh, this government's done this. I mean, you know, we had 18 years of Labour administration. Does these people, are they that stupid that they think that an incoming coalition is going to sort this out in a couple of years? Some of it was...
Well, George Osborne said he would, but he's clearly not. It's not happening, is it?
Of course it's not happening. It's going to take time. It's going to take years. But what we've got to do is have a sound fiscal policy so we just don't keep borrowing and expecting our grandchildren to have to pay it.
Okay, well, it's all very well to say that, but what would UKIP do if they did hold the balance of power at Westminster and actually had a bit of leverage here?
Well, first of all, we need to look at what the money's getting spent on. You know, we are wasting £10 billion a year as a member of the EU. And you've got the minimum wage, which isn't enough for people to live on. That needs to rise, because it's not a minimum raise to a lot of people. It's a maximum wage. You know, and I do have some, you know, I do have some real sympathy with people, certainly some of my constituents that I've spoken to, that are living on the breadline. And some of them have lost their jobs or been undercut because foreign immigrants are quite happy to work for a lot less money. And, you know, and I'm sorry if that may sound racist. It's not meant to be racist. It's a fact. It's a proven fact right up and down the country.
But businesses are bound to take people for less wages.
Well, hang on, let me finish that point, because it's really important. If the Labour Party was absolutely shocked to their boots in some of the northern cities when they started to hemorrhage votes over to UKIP, and they were coming from Labour people, hard-working Labour people that had lost their jobs because of unfettered immigration. We will stop this. That's what we will do. We will stop it. My colleague here was quite correct when he said that UKIP aren't going to form the next government. No, they're not. But what we really would love to be able to do is hold the balance of power so we can at least start to right the ship and get it going in the right direction.
Okay, but actually, so yes, we know, we get that. You want to stop unbridled immigration. But what are you going to do to fix the economy? Because George Osborne's doing his best, it seems, and it's not working.
Well, I mean, that's a very big question. And with all respect, I'm not an economist. And, you know, that's something that I couldn't possibly answer now. You know, I'm not the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I don't have the sort of knowledge.
Okay, well, let's ask Martin. He's an economist. He studied PPE at Oxford.
Well,
come on, Martin. Come on, Martin.
Well,
let's hear it.
I agree with all your comments about PFI. That was absolutely stupid. It's the most expensive way to do it. The reason they brought in PFI is because when you did a PFI deal, it didn't appear in the accounts as public expenditure. It's a private... And, of course, the city loved this because they're getting sweetheart deals.
Yeah.
So the New Labour went along with all of that. Absolutely
ridiculous.
But
how are you going to turn around the tanker,
Martin? Well, can I just finish? Can I just... The other point... The real problem is the banking system collapsed in the US, pulling down the banking system in the City of London, and that's where the money's gone, and it actually still exists. It's in the Cayman Islands, in the bank accounts of the people we bailed out.
Do you think we should have bailed out the Royal Bank of Scotland?
Well, actually, there's a very good question. The von Mises Institute, the right-wing free marketeers, they've been consistent all the way through and said we shouldn't have bailed the banks out. Just let them go. But, of course, if you do that, you've then got to face up to having a major crash, yes, with all the social consequences. And of course, if you're a free marketeer, you just believe that capitalism somehow spontaneously regenerates. Yeah. Now, what tends to happen when you have big crashes like 1929 is Hitler comes to power in Germany, then the Jews flee to Britain or wherever they can get away for, and then the fighting starts. And the fighting's already started. I think as we go into World War III, which is possibly going to happen in the next few months, the banking system will collapse. And then I'm afraid there's going to be lots of refugees running around all over the place, not just in Britain, but we're all going to have to deal with it. Because I'm afraid the system's broke. And this kind of critique of capitalism, which used to be meat and drink in the Labour Party, has now become completely non-sayable. But it's still true.
Okay, on to something a bit more local rather than the global World War III and the economy trying to fix fix the national economy.
That's coming back
just to looking local. At some of the one of the big local issues is the arena, and there's been an open letter this week in the Bristol Post by Lib Dem councillor Claire Campion-Smith to Mayor Ferguson. She says, "I write in response to your comments in the Post referring to my fellow Liberal Democrat councillors who are seeking to understand the budget for the arena project. Can you please explain why you see no difficulty in spending £83 million of capital money whilst cutting £90 million of revenue. The £83 million is the capital budget, but a large proportion of it comes from prudential borrowing. Some of that should be covered by the increase in business rates from the enterprise zone, but it will take time for this to happen. In the meantime, Bristol City Council pays the interest on a large loan. We all know that if you take out a mortgage, then the repayments must be budgeted for from the day today, expenditure, i.e. from revenue budget in the case of the council. Capital has an impact on revenue." Well, look, to decode some of the words there, essentially what she's saying is you're not letting us see the proper figures of this Bristol arena, and it looks to us as if it's going to be an absolute millstone around the city's neck for many, many years to come, possibly 10, 20 years. What are your thoughts about the arena? Because this is supposed to be a project that people have been calling for years, and finally, Mayor Ferguson is going to make it happen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, I'm not a big fan of Mayor Ferguson. I do have to agree with some of the points that this Labour councillor has made.
So it's a Lib Dem, actually.
Is she a Lib Dem?
Claire Campion-Smith,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
From Henley.
Well, whatever she is, she's made some valid points. You know, the refreshing thing I found about Bristol City Council is it's not always about party politics. You know, so you don't get the braying that you get in Westminster and everybody being yelled down, because at the end of the day, we are all there to serve the people that have been good enough to elect us.
But isn't George doing that too?
Well, no, he was elected by 14% of the city. It was one of the lowest turnouts ever. And I just hope that when the term of office that he has ends, that we go back to a proper debate where we can run the council properly, because I don't believe that George and his cohorts are doing that. He's far too fixed on vanity schemes whilst leaving important issues just to fester, because they're not that
okay. Give
sexy.
Us a, I mean this would you class this arena as a vanity scheme?
Well, no, I can see some merit in something like this, because that area around Temple Meads, as any Bristolians know, and I'm not a Bristolian, as I think whoever's listening will probably gather by my accent, but I married a lovely Bristolian lady, so I can claim to be a Bristolian. I've lived here long enough. So
that's the vanity.
Something needs to be done with that area, because it's just absolutely dreadful. But where all this money's going to come from, I don't know. I don't have the answers to what you're asking me.
Okay, so you're talking about vanity projects. That it will give us an idea of the sort of vanity projects you think that Mayor Ferguson has been pushing then.
Well, the residential parking zones, for a start. I mean, how many businesses are going to be wrecked because of this?
Yeah, but people have found it impossible to park. Something needed to be done about that, surely.
Well, then there needs to be more provisions. People want to drive their cars. You know, George Ferguson thinks that everybody wants to ride around on a bicycle, which is absolutely impractical. You know, a lot of the roadworks that have been done in and around the city centre have clearly been designed to stop traffic flow. He reminds me of Ernie Marples years ago, who anybody who's old enough to remember was the Minister of Transport, and his motto was, if it goes, stop it, if it stops, make it go. And he wanted to and he was the guy that brought out traffic wardens and double yellow lines and all this sort of thing. But
He owned his own road construction company too, as well as being being Minister of Transport under the Heath government, I think it was.
Well, just finish my point. Yeah, I just think you've got to really go. You really got to look at Bristol's transport infrastructure. And people want to drive their cars. And I know a lot of the Lib Dem tree-hugging sandal wearers will probably be up in arms about that. But people want to drive their cars. They don't think that they can get around everywhere on a bicycle. And the roads around in Bristol, with the cycleways and all this sort of thing, have restricted the traffic flow. And the accidents that have happened as well. I mean, I read a report that the Conservative leader, Mark Weston, wrote, and where there was a cycling charity that wanted to allow cyclists to run red lights. It just beggars belief that somebody would actually write that. I was privy to a little map of where accidents have happened with cyclists, and they're all at T-junctions and traffic lights because they just run red lights. Not all of them, I'm being very generalised, I know, but I think there's a lot of car drivers out there that can all tell you a story of what they've seen and some of the appalling behaviour of cyclists on the roads of Bristol. I'm amazed that there's not more of them getting...
But it's not an equal battle, is it, between a car and a motorcycle, Michael?
No, it's not. But the roads
are very easy for the car driver to... No, the roads are for everybody. The roads are for all sorts of people, surely. Not just for cars.
No, primarily they're for cars.
I mean, you're coming across...
We've got over 50 million cars in this country, and
the... When was the last time a cyclist killed a car driver?
Well, unless he dragged him out of the car and beat him to death, I don't know.
Well, cyclists can cause accidents. But with cars, I mean, as a driver, I see cyclists sometimes doing silly stuff. It's just making me do something silly because I've got to overtake them and so on.
Yeah, I take your point, Tony. I know it's your job to challenge and be controversial, but I mean, if we boil this all down to common sense, cyclists are road users and they have a right to use the road. But if they do, then they should adhere to the rules of the road. And they should have an identification on them somewhere, so if they run a red light or pull out in front of you or cause a major accident, they can't just disappear down the next alley without any redress to the law. That surely is common sense.
Well, that's the police's job to do something about that. Anyway, big debate in the House of Commons today. Parliament's been recalled this week, and we're going to be hearing after the 6 o'clock news David Cameron's speech to the United Nations justifying being part of this coalition of the willing, or coalition of the killing, as some people have called it, in the Middle East, to do something about this terrorist organisation, ISIS. And there has been a debate on BBC Parliament in Parliament, been covered live by the BBC's Parliament Channel, but I was dismayed to hear today that there was no coverage on 5 Live, which is supposed to be a 24-hour news channel. No discussion about it at all, just the odd clip on their hourly news bulletins. The entire day has been taken up by, guess what, the golf, the Ryder Cup. Very exciting shots on all sorts of greens between the British and the Americans vying for winning the Ryder Cup. So let's anyway bypass the BBC's blackout on this very important debate going on in the Commons, and hear something from just a little bit earlier on today. And this was a contribution. I just chose one which I thought was I listened to a few, which was a particularly interesting one. And this is from the Conservative MP Sir Edward Lee, and really he's I suppose indicating that this could be just simply Iraq War 2, and he wasn't very approving of the first attempt. So let's have a listen to that. It's about 6 minutes now, but this is his contribution to today's debate of the recall of Parliament.
Sir Edward Lee. Mr. Deputy Speaker, I visited these Christian villages near Mosul that are most affected by Islamic State. I have heard myself the harrowing tales of women losing husbands and sons and daughters to death and kidnapping. And it is appalling to talk to a mother and hear her say that she last saw her son or her husband going to church, never seen him again. But attacks against Iraqi Christians and other minorities, such as Yazidis, have been happening for years, ever since our misconceived and misplaced invasion of Iraq. Yeah. That replaced an admittedly brutal strongman who protected minorities with chaos. For years, I and others have argued that Assyrian Christians in the Mosul Plain needed their own province within Iraq to defend themselves. And frankly, we've been met with a complacent response from the Foreign Office. Now it is almost too late. The Kurds have failed to protect them. Perhaps they haven't got the resources. The truth is that up to now we've done everything wrong. In our zealous liberalism, we have encouraged revolutions across the Middle East and then been profoundly shocked when the forces we have helped to unleash have turned against us. In that sense, the British government is indirectly culpable in fostering the conditions for jihadism to thrive in Iraq and Syria. Not surprising that last year in Malula, a Christian village in Syria, one civilian said to the BBC, "Tell the West that we sent you, St. Paul, 2,000 years ago to take you from the darkness, and you have sent us terrorists to kill us." In that sense, brutal as he is, Assad is a natural ally against jihadism. Yes.
Well, I'm grateful to my honourable friend. Is he saying that we should not be supporting the Syrian Free Forces against their campaign against the Assad regime, as some of our Gulf states are urging us to?
We would all want Syria to be a democratic, modern country. We would all want the Syrian Free Forces to win this battle. But a year ago, we were being asked in this House of Commons to bomb Assad. Now we are being asked to stand on our head. I've heard of us being asked to bomb your opponents. I've heard of you being asked to bomb to support the friends of you. But what we're doing is extraordinary, and it makes no sense. I give way to the honourable gentleman.
Right, honourable member, very much giving way. This is a very, very important point that the right honourable member is making. The idea that somehow we could support the Syrian government against the extremists. But the paradox, the problem here, is the only legitimacy now for the Syrian regime is the existence of those terrorists. What possible motive would Bashar al-Assad have to remove them so long as they remain his main reason for international support?
I accept all these points. And so the government tell us that we're not going to follow the Americans down the road of bombing ISIL in Syria because of the complexities that my two honourable friends have just outlined. But of course, this border doesn't exist. Our government says we are only going to bomb ISIS in Iraq, a solution that makes no military sense whatsoever. And what will this achieve? Most of us backbenchers have no idea what the intelligence says. I suspect it is scanty. No journalist is embedded in IS, a suicidal thing to do. So how long will this last, this operation last? Will bombing only in Iraq seriously impede IS? We only have a tiny number of planes based a long way away. Once we were told that never in the field of human conflict so much was owned by so many to so few. Now, never have so few been asked by so many to achieve so much with no clear aim in sight. But IS, of course, is winning against the Iraqi government. It's not winning against the Iraqi government because of their superior armour or its command and control that is easily bombed. It's winning because the Iraqi government is corrupt, because the army which we armed ran away. Are we going to bomb 4x4s racing across the desert? No, make no mistake about this. This is about our amour prop as a nation. Now, there's nothing wrong in that. We are a member, as we've been told again and again in this debate. We are members of the G8, of the Security Council. But if you want to act with a big stick in the world, you must will the means. And what have we been doing with our armed forces over the last 4 years? And how many planes have we got to bomb ISIL? What serious difference will we make? These are the realities which we all know. But we are where we are. We have caused this mess, and we should apologise to the people of the region for it. We have no idea where this will end. We have no idea what our bombing campaign will achieve or how long it would take. But there's the rub. We caused this mess. And I just want to make a personal point before I sit down. I don't think that I personally, for personal reasons, can walk away on the other side of the road from those desperate women I talked to in the Mosul province. I have stood beside the wrecked tomb of the prophet Nahum in the Christian village of Al-Kosh, which is directly threatened. I've talked to the monks living nearby, living in fear. How strange that writing 2,500 years ago in sublime language, the prophet Nahum warns us of the fall of the Assyrians and their civilization. And their descendants are now meeting the same fate. Therefore, although I have severe doubts what this will achieve, and with a heavy heart and full of foreboding, I will vote for this motion tonight.
Well, there we go. Most of his speech was basically saying the whole thing's silly and undoable, but at the end of the day, he's going to vote for it. Anyway, Michael Frost, you're the first UKIP councillor in the city of Bristol. You're based up in Henbury. What are your thoughts about how this vote should go today in the Commons?
Well, I can see that it's a very emotive issue, and on the surface of things, yeah, let's send a whole load of planes over there and bomb the bejesus out of it.
But I think it's about four planes, isn't it?
Oh, is it? Right. I don't actually think that that will solve the problem. You cannot win a war from the air, and that's what, you know, we would be attempting to do, because we don't want to put our own young men and women at risk on the ground. That's really what it's all about. But something has to be done. We can't have this bunch of religious maniacs looning around the Middle East, beheading people, you know, whenever they feel like it.
So you're talking about the Saudi government?
Say again?
Are you talking about the Saudi government?
I'm talking about the Islamic State movement. The Saudi government, yeah. That's very naughty going on that. Well, I do get the drift you're going on. No, we have to do something about it. I also agree with what Nigel Farage said at the UKIP conference, which has been going on today, is that there is a suspicion that these people actually want us to bomb them so that they can then, you know, surge up and invite a jihad against everybody in the world. They're clearly mad, they're clearly deranged, and they have to be stopped. But I think playing them at their own game isn't really going to achieve anything.
I mean, if we do go ahead and decide to be bombing them, ISIS in Iraq, because apparently we're not supposed to be doing that in Syria, that's the job of the United States, it seems. Do you think that will actually help ISIS by recruiting people if they see that this sort of thing is happening? I mean, many Iraqis might feel, well, actually, the enemy, older enemy, is back again.
Yeah, I think that is, you know, I think you have a point there, and I would agree with that. But it's this, you know, these people are tribal people. They have been, you know, murdering each other for decades over different beliefs. That their society is a tribal society. Trying to install what we know as democracy is just not going to work. Churchill said this at the turn of the last century when he was in Mesopotamia, and he referred to Islam as Muhammadism, and he said that it, you know, having studied it and looked at it, it is totally incompatible with the Western way of life, and we see that every day. Every day you turn the newspaper over, and there's something about, you know, Muslim terrorists. Now, I know that all Muslims are not terrorists, but at the moment, all the terrorists are Muslims, and we have our own issues to deal with in this country. There was a whole bunch of them arrested this week. This chap Chowdhury, who's been an instigator for years, he was the chap, by the way, that was going to actually march down. The name's forgot. Just escaped me at the moment. Where they brought all the soldiers back?
Wootton Bassett.
Royal Wootton Bassett is now. Thank you. Sorry, I went a bit blank. He wanted to actually march down that high street, and I just could not believe what he said, because I feared for his life.
But that's his point of view. Should he be arrested for that?
No, but I think it would show very, very poor respect.
But I mean, and one of the things that Sir Edward Lee was saying there was that we created this mess in the Middle East. It wasn't perfect before, but it's much, much worse now than it was before we intervened back in 2003. Have you any thoughts about what we should be doing right now to put, or should we just completely back off and let people organise their own affairs?
Well, that's one school of thought, is that we should just back off and let them to it. I think that would that would look very irresponsible and possibly cowardly as well, because we did play a large hand in creating what we've got. I think the solution lies in the people themselves having to solve this problem, because it's something that has been going on for decades.
Okay, so Martin Summers, what's your thoughts on Sir Edward Lee's contribution to the Iraq War II discussions going on? Parliament's been recalled today.
Well, I mean, it's good to hear that there's people on the Tory benches who've got their heads screwed on. It's a shame that he's not going to vote against. It'll be very interesting to see who votes for this tonight and who votes against it, because the three major parties, they've whipped everybody in. But there will be rebels. There will be Labour rebels, there will be Liberal rebels, there will be Conservative rebels. And I suspect also that Plaid Cymru, the SNP and the SDLP will not vote for it.
Well, we'll keep an eye on who the various MPs around Bristol, yeah, which way they vote, and let you know next week.
Yeah, I suspect they're all going to vote for, because they're all basically climbing the greasy pole. That's the reality.
Certainly Stephen Williams said he was going to be, yeah, voting for it. But anyway, what about the point he made there, Martin, which I thought was one of the most fascinating parts of all of this, which is that the border between Iraq and Syria doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. Well, so actually, the idea...
Well, it's only gone as long as the Islamic State exists. I mean, the reason why we're not going to attack Syria is because the Attorney General has made it absolutely clear to the government that it would be illegal. The Americans are attacking Syria. That is, in fact, illegal. Now, that's just a fact. Now, the other fact that people have got to get their heads around, going back to the 1980s, is that the Western Intelligence Services, with MI6 in the lead, have armed and trained these people for years. And in actual fact, British Special Forces were training ISIS militants inside Jordan just over a year ago. And I'll bet you there are people in Hereford who know exactly what I'm talking about. So if we want to actually stop these people, we need to actually hit their funding, which is coming from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Bahrain, all the people that actually joined the Americans in this airstrike yesterday in Syria, that have to be democratic revolutions in those countries, which is going to be very bloody in the end. And but of course we're in favour of a bloody revolution. We've been fighting the Syrian army. They've lost 70,000 people already fighting ISIS. Are we ready to lose 70,000 people to stop them? I don't think we are. Now, what we could do is just back off and let the Syrian army finish the job. But since we've been actually training people to fight the Syrian army, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But people in MI6 know exactly what I'm talking about, and we should actually arrest those people. Colonel so-and-so, we'll find out who's actually been training ISIS.
Okay,
that's
Martin.
What we'll do. That's the way to stop them.
Okay, Martin, another story this week, which I found particularly interesting. This interesting angle on the religious stuff going on over here and how this might affect it, so-called Islamic terrorism, is the vicars are set to reveal the secrets of confession, according to the Daily Mail last weekend. The Church of England might axe the 400-year-old sacred law which lets the clergy report to let clergy report sex attackers. The Church of England might relax rules to allow clergy to reveal serious crimes. Priests have been banned for disclosing criminal offences for 400 years. Former Bishop of Chelmsford John Gladwin is pressing for the change, and it follows the Anglican Church of Australia's decision to allow clergy to disclose. So this is the idea is that for hundreds of years, 400 years we're being told here, Michael, that when you tell some talk to a priest, a vicar in the Church of England about something that may be a criminal offence, in order to confess it to them, that they're supposed to keep that quiet. Now what they're saying is in future that won't happen. What are your thoughts about this? Is it a big
think
change?
I think it's absolutely correct. I don't have any religious beliefs, so it's difficult for me to debate this in the same way that a Catholic would or an Anglican would. But you've only got to look at the facts, and I think let's just deal with the facts. The Catholic Church is absolutely awash with paedophile priests. They've spent millions in America trying to cover it up or paying people off, you know, because of these disgusting behaviour of their church and their church members and church men, you know, all in the name of God. I think it is abominable.
Well, to be fair, Whitehall and Westminster, there's a supposed to be an inquiry into historic abuse there, which has been kicked into the long grass. The latest person.
There's also one in Bristol, and I wrote, and if our crime commissioner's listening, Sue Mount Stevens, would you please reply to the letter that I wrote you?
Well, would you want to tell us about that?
No, because I don't have my notes and my. I didn't realise I might be talking about that today, but there is...
Is there actually an inquiry going on in Bristol, then?
Yes, there is.
And what do we know about it?
We don't know very much about it at the moment, and I'm I'm not going to talk about that now,
okay,
because there, it is very, very contentious. We don't know if there's been a cover-up. I have asked our crime commissioner, I've given her a few details, and I've copied her in on some websites that have some evidence on them, and I'm waiting for a reply. I haven't had one.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about the idea of ending this idea of confidentiality with the vicar?
Well, I mean, there's not that much confession goes on in the Anglican Church. I mean, my mother was an Anglican priest, not that I'm very active in the church. But I think, in principle, people should report crimes to the relevant authorities.
But I mean, isn't in this situation, for years and years, the vicar has been a little bit like, almost like a solicitor, someone you would go to for confidential advice, and they're saying now that that advice won't be
confidential. Well, I mean, if the ruling changes, people will have to bear that in mind when they go and talk to the priest or the vicar, won't they? They may grass you up if you tell them that you've been abusing somebody.
It's amazing they hold them in that reverence, because years and years ago, to follow a path into the church was normally the mark of a failed public schoolboy, and that's really all that they thought, that their parents thought they were fit for.
Well, that's a very harsh judgment and a very wide one. Actually, to be fair, I mean, a lot of people in the church, it's not very well paid, and they're actually dedicated people. Some aren't. Some are a disgrace. But most people who are active in the church today are extremely nice people who mean well, and they don't earn a lot of money. They come in for a lot of rather negative criticism.
You don't know what they're thinking, though, do you?
Okay, on to another issue, and this is going back to immigration again. Alice Gross missing. Latvian police can't arrest the suspect, Arnis Zalkins. The prime suspect in the investigation into the missing teenager, Alice Gross, cannot be arrested if he's returned to his native Latvia, police said. British police do not have enough evidence to secure the European arrest warrant needed to detain Arnis Zalkins. The convicted killer was seen cycling just minutes behind the 14-year-old before she disappeared 4 weeks ago from a canal side path in West London. Mr. Zalkins went missing 6 days later. Authorities in Latvia have already indicated they cannot arrest him without a warrant. The law is, unless you're ready to charge somebody, unless you have evidence to charge them, you can't arrest, said Scotland Yard's commander, Graham McNulty. He said the builder would have been arrested if he was in the UK and we were aware of his whereabouts. Scotland Yard officers travelled to Latvia as part of their inquiry to speak with members of his family amid suspicions that he'd fled Britain after going missing on the 3rd of November. Mr. Zalkins, 41, travelled to Britain in 2007 after he was released from prison after beating and stabbing his wife, Rudite, to death. He lived with his partner and young daughter in West London until he disappeared. Now, Martin, I'm going to start with you on this one, and this is really worrying, isn't it? When you've got a convicted murderer wandering the streets in Britain, the British police don't know anything about it. Now they suspect that he may have been involved in the disappearance of Alice Gross, but they can't issue a European arrest warrant, apparently, because they don't have enough evidence. Although, indications are it may well have been him that killed her.
Well, I think, if you're talking about specific cases, it's quite clear. I mean, look at what happened in the Assange case. If you haven't got the evidence, then you can't issue an arrest warrant. And that, unfortunately, is the bottom line. I suppose you could say that helps the criminals, but in a way, that's how the law works. You've got to have sufficient evidence if you want to chase somebody up.
Seems like the double standards going on here with Assange, getting the European arrest warrant being easy to obtain to get Assange,
What Assange was saying is that they didn't give out an arrest warrant. That's the whole point. They didn't have enough evidence for an arrest warrant.
Anyway, Michael, what's your thoughts
on
this one?
Well, we've gone full circle now, haven't we? We've gone right the way back to, unfettered immigration. If we had proper border controls and this chap had to present himself, at our border police or whatever we want to call them, unless he was entering the country with false documents, we wouldn't have let him in, because I don't think they like to let in convicted murderers. But I have to agree with my colleague here that at the moment, all they can really charge him with is riding a bike behind this poor girl that's gone missing. So there isn't any real evidence. I believe they dragged the canal and found a knife, but I'm amazed they didn't find all kinds of things, if you start dragging the canal in London.
Well, this guy, Arnis Zalkins, was arrested in 2009, also over an allegation of indecent assault close to his home in Ealing. Mm. The case was closed after the alleged victim declined to press charges, and inquiries about CCTV and appeals for witnesses were unsuccessful. Scotland Yard launched a review of its investigation, which will look into the time it took to put Mr. Zalkins at the forefront of the investigation, as his arrest over the indecent assault allegation would have been flagged up by police databases. Commander McNulty said the builder probably would not have come to the attention of the police inquiry to find Alice Gray Rose had he not gone missing himself. The individual was not somebody who had convictions in the UK, not somebody who we had a significant amount of intelligence at all about, but they didn't know he was a murderer.
No. Well, at the moment, it's all circumstantial, isn't it? Because what can the police do? Yes, if he was still here and they could get hold of him, at least they could interview him. And then who knows what would have become of that. But it just confirms the point that I made, and so did our party leader today, that we cannot, at the moment, as members of the EU, control who can come in and leave this country. That we've no idea how many people from Europe are here, we've no idea how many people are leaving, and we've certainly got no idea how many convicted robbers, rapists, murderers, and all kinds of other criminal vermin that have swarmed into our country since the borders have become relaxed.
Well, lots of very good, honest people too. Finally, tax dodging as high as ever, despite government claims, with £80 billion lost every year. What are we going to do about tax dodgers?
What are we going to do?
You've got half a minute.
Well, I think really that I don't think the Inland Revenue have got enough people. Because, you know, if
more civil servants?
Well, you need more civil servants targeted. But they should stop trying to chase the odd guy in the street who might have dodged a couple of hundred quid and go after the real fat cats that have got away with millions in some cases. A typical thing, it's about with VAT. There's many, many billionaires coming to live in London, and because they reside somewhere else, they don't pay any VAT on all the expensive stuff they bring.
Martin?
I think that's right. The PSC have pointed out that each individual...
Who is this?
Public Services Union have pointed out that the each individual tax officer
PCS,
more than pays for their salary.
Yeah.
And so part of the austerity measures, they've cut the tax officers. Mm. Now, that is just nuts.
That doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense.
That's all we've got time for now. Murdoch News at 6 appears to be on its way. That you've been listening to Bristol's first UKIP councillor. That's Michael Bristol Frost from Henbury. After the news, we'll be looking at ISIS, fracking, as well as the post office, the Royal Mail.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, MPs have backed government plans to join airstrikes against Islamic State in Iraq.
The ayes to the right, 524, the noes to the left, 43. So the ayes have it, the ayes have it.
The decision could see the first RAF strikes within hours. Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg told the Commons, "We must act.
We do so mindful of the mistakes and lessons of the past, but we do so with lawful authority, with clear objectives, and with the support and active participation of a broad coalition of international opinion, which is saying to ISIL, enough is enough."
Labour MP Paul Flynn was one of 43 to vote against the intervention.
"We all want to damage and defeat these people who are carrying out these terrible acts, but we're on a slippery slope to what I believe will be a prolonged war, because having done this, we'll go into Syria next, we'll have troops on the ground."
Meanwhile, Shadow Education Minister Roshanara Ali has resigned from Labour's front bench in order to abstain from the vote. She's concerned that military action will create further bloodshed for the people of Iraq. In other news, Dave Lee Travis has avoided jail after being handed a 3-month suspended sentence for indecent assault. The judge told the former DJ the assault in 1995 was unpleasant and that he